From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. Now, let me take just a moment right at the top here to say thank you to everyone who sent messages of support and concern during my absence. I am particularly grateful to Dr. Jay Michelson, who agreed to step in as host of this show on a moment's notice, and to Rabbi Jack Moline for his support and consideration. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very grateful for that support, for every one of you. Today, as the world around us changes in unsettling and unexpected ways, it's more important than ever to provide this platform for thoughtful, respectful dialogue and voices that all too often go unheard. For more information on how you can keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, February 26th is the Christian Transfiguration Sunday, as well as the first day of the Baha'i Intercalary Observance. The 28th is Shrove Tuesday, and March 1st is Ash Wednesday for Christians, marking the start of the pre-Easter season of Lent. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, a fundraising campaign by Muslim American activists to pay for repairs to a vandalized Jewish cemetery in Missouri raised almost $100,000 in mere days. Meanwhile, arson is blamed for a Texas mosque burning down, which led to the local synagogue inviting their Muslim neighbors to come worship in the Jewish space. Inspiring as those and other stories are, the surge in anti-Muslim incidents continues unabated, and the epidemic of bomb threats targeting Jewish community centers nationwide is likewise continuing. Meanwhile, the president finally spoke out against religious bias crimes. But it was clearly too little too late for advocates of interreligious cooperation and respect, including the highly regarded Anne Frank Center. Legislators are getting an earful in their home districts as crowds gather to object to threats to health care, immigrant rights, and Muslim Americans. The opposition group Indivisible now has chapters in every state in the nation. The White House has promised a rewritten Muslim ban order was coming, resolving the fundamental problems multiple courts have identified and used to block the policy. Now, that order has been postponed till next week. But the administration did find time to rescind guidance from the Obama era regarding transgender students' access to appropriate bathrooms, while an astounding number of political right religious leaders are celebrating. Let's remember that there hasn't been one transgender person found guilty of transgressions in public restrooms, while the number of politicians guilty for such transgressions stands at 3. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
And this is the protection of the nation from foreign terrorist entry into the United States. We all know what that means.
In what is a dark and difficult time for many Americans, one heartening theme that has emerged is uncompromising interreligious cooperation at a level we haven't always seen before. Stories of Jews sharing worship space with Muslim victims of arson, Muslims raising funds to restore a vandalized Jewish cemetery, and many other such instances. So also with the administration's Muslim ban and aggressive anti-refugee posturing. A leading refugee agency for over 100 years is HIAS, And I'm looking forward to welcoming Rabbi Jeannie Rosen to the show later this hour.
I'm excited to announce today that Dr. Michael Gion and his team have used our Spitzer Space Telescope to determine that there are actually seven Earth-sized planets orbiting the nearby TRAPPIST-1 star about 40 light years away.
A lot of us gazed skyward this week as NASA announced the discovery of a set of exoplanets that may be compatible with life. On this week's show, we'll get some insights from Dr. Jennifer Wiseman, an astrophysicist and director of the Dialogue on Science, Ethics, and Religion at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. But first,
for helping us elect what will be one of the greatest presidents that ever served this country.
President Trump rescinded the Obama guidelines on transgender. And
from the left, their base, there's a technical term for their base, bat crap crazy.
I want to thank you for finally inviting me to CPAC.
Islam and the Bolsheviks have never parted company. You've got the Muslim Brotherhood operating in this country. You've got the radical left communist groups. And they were looking forward to a Hillary Clinton presidency.
Peter Montgomery, senior fellow at People for the American Way, attended CPAC to see what the far right's talking about in an age of Trump, and we caught up with him after the first full day at the Gaylord Convention Center. Peter, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Welton. Happy to be here.
Would you briefly explain what the annual CPAC is?
Sure. This is one of the big annual gatherings of the political right wing in America. One of them is the Values Voter Summit, which is more of the religious right. And this one, CPAC, is more of the rest of the right. Business, economic, national security, far right, tends to be a little bit younger, a little bit more libertarian, but it's also got some of the religious right folks there as well.
Now, Peter, you've been to CPAC and similar gatherings before. How different was it this year, with conservatives feeling resurgent right now?
Well, on the one hand, they're feeling triumphant, and there's no question that that's a big part of the feeling. But there was also a sense of turning over the movement to Donald Trump. You know, in the past, there was a lot of sort of principled conservative opposition to Trump that was evident in previous CPACs, and that has pretty much been obliterated. The first day at CPAC featured adoring softball interviews with Betsy DeVos, with Reince Priebus, with Steve Bannon. There's a lot of, you know, embracing the Trump administration in all its forms.
How dominant were religious conservatives at CPAC?
Religious conservatives have never been the dominant presence at CPAC, although one of the main sponsors is the Heritage Foundation, which certainly is part of the religious right. Betsy DeVos was one of the main speakers, but this was more about acknowledging the Trump administration taking over the movement.
Peter, what did you see or hear that really stood out as noteworthy?
One of the things that I was most struck by was the morning speech by Dan Schneider, who's one of the leaders of the American Conservative Union, which sponsors CPAC. And he gave this remarkable speech attacking the alt-right and trying to suggest that the alt-right is not really from the right, but is somehow a leftist fascist movement that is trying to confuse people and associate itself with the conservative movement. And that was particularly astonishing because just a couple hours later, the chair of the American Conservative Union was doing a softball interview on the main stage with Steve Bannon, who is the biggest promoter of the alt-right. So it's an astonishing effort at propaganda and historical revisionism, and I think it's going to be one of the most noteworthy things out of the conference.
Peter, looking at the CPAC schedule, I'm struck by how much focus there is on campus activism. Is this a new focus for the conference?
Well, CPAC has always had a big youth contingent. A lot of college students come. There's a lot of organizations present whose mission is to train the next generation of conservative leaders. And that's, it's again, very evident this year. There's a lot of young people. There's an effort to sort of promote a kind of hip conservatism, you know, people walking around selling T-shirts that say big government sucks and socialism sucks. And we started off the day with a sort of Jimi Hendrix light electric guitar rendition of the national anthem, which is probably not something you would hear at the Values Voter Summit.
What else can the agenda tell us about where the right is likely to focus its energies in the Trump era?
Well, one of the events that I went to was about climate change. And this was an event sponsored by an organization that's funded by the oil and gas industry. And, you know, the gist of that argument was, of their argument was not only is climate change wrongly interpreting the data, but that it's all a huge scam by Marxist watermelons, which was their term for people who are green on the outside but red on the inside. And the whole environmental climate change movement has basically been faked in order to destroy the Western economies. And that, of course, was all about justifying the Trump administration going after EPA, trying to abolish its regulation of carbon dioxide and other climate change factors. So I think we're going to be seeing a big assault on regulation and the regulatory state, and that's also been reflected in the agenda.
There's been a lot of media focus on the new levels of organizing and activism in progressive circles, but is the same thing happening on the right?
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of ongoing organizing on the right. I mean, part of the reason that we have Trump in the White House and we have Republicans in control of Congress and so many state governments is that there's been a major investment in organizing on the right through the Koch brothers political networks. So that is certainly proceeding apace. It's not going to slow down during the Trump era.
Peter, what are you paying the most attention to right now? That's important for us, knowing what all you know. And what worries you the most?
I think one of the things that worries me the most is the continuing attacks on the media. Trump's speech on Friday morning at CPAC was also focused on continuing his attacks on what he called the dishonest media. I think that one of the strongest weapons in his arsenal going forward is going to be that so many of his followers refuse to believe anything bad about him because they have been trained so effectively to see anything that does not come from the right-wing propaganda machine as false or dishonest or fake media. And I think that is going to be very dangerous going forward. It allows him to misrepresent his deportation policy. He tells us it's just about getting rid of murderers and drug dealers, when in fact it's far broader and more damaging than that. So I'm worried about his use of media, his sowing of distrust of news, which really enables the rest of his destructive agenda.
Peter Montgomery is senior fellow at People for the American Way, a prolific writer. Peter is associate editor at Religion Dispatches magazine. His work also appears at the important rightwingwatch.org website and elsewhere. Peter, thanks so much for all you do for us and for once again bringing your experience and analysis to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me on again, Welton.
A couple of years ago, we introduced you to Dr. Jennifer Wiseman, an astrophysicist who heads up the Dialogue on Science, Ethics, and Religion at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Dr. Wiseman, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
We wanted to have you back this week because space has been in the headlines, but also because DOSER hosted an important event last weekend at the often tense intersection of religion and science. What was on the agenda of the climate policy discussion?
This Dialogue on Science, Ethics, and Religion program is an effort by a major scientific society to facilitate better interactions between the scientific community and religious communities. So the Scientific Society is the American Association for the Advancement of Science. We're the world's largest science advocacy society. And this particular dialogue program was started about 22 years ago, and we do a lot of things to help facilitate positive interactions between scientists and religious groups. So at the big AAAS annual conference last weekend, we held a symposium there sponsored by our dialogue program regarding how religious communities actually are playing a key role in helping global leaders to take positive steps toward addressing climate change. And so sometimes, you know, we hear that religious communities may be seen to be at odds with scientists and other folks when thinking about climate change or how to address it or whether to acknowledge it and that kind of thing. But our symposium showed how religious groups who have a deep care and concern about creation and the environment have actually played a key role in helping construct positive ideas for how the world can address climate change in the coming years.
Mm-hmm. What are the biggest obstacles right now to getting closer to meeting the objectives you have for these kinds of forums?
There's a great hunger, I'd say, to have more of these types of interactions where scientists can interact with religious leaders, often in their own communities. Many times scientists and religious groups or leaders don't have a lot of just casual interaction or even formal interactions in their own communities, but it's often very important, and we try to just set the architecture up for that to happen. In this case, for the symposium that we held, we had a scientist from the University of Minnesota, Dr. Jessica Hellman, who talked about some of the science that climate scientists are seeing regarding the change in our Earth's climate and what's driving that. And then we had a pastor, a Reverend Fletcher Harper, who leads an interfaith organization called Green Faith. Green Faith is an interfaith partnership for the environment where he outlined how religious communities can get involved in doing things that's in keeping with their faith commitments to addressing these global problems resulting from climate change or causing it. And religious communities are often particularly concerned for caring for the poor and the world's neediest folks, and these are the people who are already being affected by climate change the most and will be in the future. And so religious groups often play a big role in ministering to people around the world who are in impoverished situations. And these are the folks who are most dependent and affected by changes in climate. So he talked about how religious communities can actually take positive action, both to address the root causes of climate change and also to address those who are being affected and will be affected by it. And then we also had Dr. Matthew Nisbet from Northeastern University talking about what frames people's opinions. You know, a lot of people's opinions about this topic and others are framed not so much by the data they hear, but by the voices they trust. And so talking about how to get issues like environmental care framed in such a way that people of faith commitments can address these things in keeping with their faith. So it was a very interesting conversation. And then we had Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, who's a climate scientist from Texas Tech, be a discussant. And she's just a marvelous witness and ambassador because she operates both in the climate science community, understanding what's happening scientifically, but she also operates in the church community and is just a wonderful spokesperson interacting with churches and understanding their concerns as well. So it was a terrific symposium, and we hope that it'll be available online soon through our website at AAAS.org/dozer, D-O-S-E-R.
Dr. Wiseman, you're an astrophysicist. How exciting is the discovery of these exoplanets?
Well, there was some exciting news this week that one star system has seven planets that are basically Earth-sized orbiting that star. Now, we've already, over the last few years, different astronomers using different kinds of telescopes have detected literally thousands of planets outside of our own solar system. But this is the first time we've seen a collection of Earth-sized planets orbiting one star. And it isn't that far away. I mean, it's still a very long way for us human beings, but it's only 20 light years away, which astronomically speaking isn't all that far away. So it means that it will be possible to study these Earth-sized planets in more detail in the future. So it's quite exciting.
How did this happen? Because there's a new level of accuracy in what we can see in space, or is it more a case that we're always scanning the skies and just stumbled across these bodies?
No, astronomers are now looking very carefully at different kinds of stars to assess what kinds of stars may have what kinds of planets. I mean, this is really all quite incredible because back when I was in graduate school, we didn't know of any planets mm-hmm. outside of our solar system. We, of course, know the planets in our own solar system, and we had a lot of science fiction movies and things that made us imagine that there might be planets around other stars, but we hadn't discovered any. And then the techniques of detecting them grew to the point where indirectly these planets were starting to be detected. It's very hard to find planets around other stars because in most cases the star is much, much brighter, maybe a billion times brighter than these little planets that only reflect starlight. So the little planets get caught in the glare of the star. So you have to almost always detect them, not by just taking a picture of the system, in which case you'd never see the little planets, but by seeing their effect. In some systems, the planet orbits in front of its parent star. Its plane is along our line of sight, and that not only drops the total amount of starlight we see from that star as it passes in front, but we also can see as the light from the star passes through the outer realm of the atmosphere of that planet, that atmosphere will absorb certain colors of the starlight, and we can tell from that absorption what's in the atmosphere of the planet, so we can study a little bit about its character. So now, using these various techniques, we know of thousands of planets outside our solar system. And the next step, of course, is to build even better telescopes that can help us to look in much more detail at the atmospheres of these planets and see if they look like they might be habitable for life or even have biological activity. So that's kind of the exciting next step in this exploration bonanza here.
What opportunities for new knowledge and exploration does this discovery really offer?
Well, it is, of course, one of the hottest topics in astronomy now. Now that we know that there are planets outside our solar system, we call these exoplanets. The exo means outside, so planets outside our solar system. Now we want to be able to study them in more detail to find out, do they have oceans? Do they have continents? Do they have a breathable atmosphere with oxygen, nitrogen, things like our own atmosphere? Do they have products of life? Our own atmosphere, if you went away from Earth and looked back at it carefully, you would see that our atmosphere is filled with oxygen, and that's because we have plants that, through their photosynthesis, are continually replenishing our atmosphere with oxygen. So you could tell that there was biological activity going on. We want to do that same kind of study for many of these exoplanets. And, of course, it's basic research, trying to understand the nature of planets in general and whether our own solar system is typical or atypical. And, of course, we're all curious to know whether there might be another habitable or inhabited place, maybe with simple life, maybe with complex life, who knows. But it's part of the whole exploration process, which is driven by scientific curiosity. But I also think it's driven by something very basic in our human nature to want to know who we are and where we fit in to the larger universe and to God's creation, if you will. So I think it's a really exciting time.
Let me go just very briefly from that specific thing to something general. Would you talk briefly about the AAAS Force for Science campaign? Because it seems really important right now.
Yes, so the AAAS is the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and so the AAAS is a supporter of all different types of science, everything from biology to astronomy, chemistry, physics, geology, and upholds basically the place of science as a way of investigating the natural world and being able to come up with answers to scientific questions and being able to articulate that in such a way that it helps society through journals and through other things. So now at this current point in time, the AAAS is really feeling that a lot of people want to make sure that it's known that science is important, that science should be a key player, an input to decisions that are made in society about that involve science and technology, that actual scientific data should play a key role in those kinds of things, and it's important. So I think the AAAS now is just getting behind this more public surge of support for science and wants to support people who are interested in keeping science as a key player in providing information. Now, I'll add that science doesn't answer all kinds of questions about all kinds of things. Science is a really good tool, in my view, as a scientist, to answer certain types of questions, such as we were discussing earlier. How do we know that the climate's changing, and how would we know that humans are playing a part in that? That's mm-hmm. a good science question that we can address with our tool, or talking about these exoplanets and astronomy and cosmology, or measuring chemical compositions of things. Those are scientific types of questions. But there are the bigger questions then of, well, how do we use this knowledge? And that's where, you know, part of our title comes in for our program, our dialogue on science, ethics, and religion is, you know, there are ethical questions about using science and technology that go beyond just the science itself. And, of course, religion, there are certainly philosophical and theological and religious aspects of looking at what it means to be human and how we should live our lives. And those are questions often beyond the tools of science. So the AAAS supports science as a part, as a piece of society that includes these other inputs as well, and hopefully will give us a more holistic sense of what it means to be human and how to make choices on the public level that affect everybody's lives.
Dr. Wiseman, before we end the interview, please tell our listeners how to keep up on the work of the Dialogue on Science, Ethics, and Religion, as well as the American Association for the Advancement of Science.
Sure. So the American Association for the Advancement of Science has a website. It's just AAAS.org, AAAS.org. And our Dialogue on Science, Ethics, and Religion program, or DOSER, is just AAAS.org/DOSER.
Dr. Jennifer Wiseman is an astrophysicist and director of the Dialogue on Science, Ethics, and Religion at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Dr. Wiseman, it is always great to have you on the show. Thanks so much for being with us once again on State of Belief Radio.
It's my pleasure. Have a wonderful day.
Regular listeners will remember hearing Rabbi Jenny Rosen a couple of years ago as one of the honorees of the Auburn Seminary Lives of Commitment Celebration. Video of that event is available at stateofbelief.com. You may want to look at it again. As Vice President for Community Engagement at HIAS, a Jewish agency that's been serving refugees since 1881, Rabbi Rosen is on the front lines of an issue that's as contentious as it's ever been, thanks in great part to the way national politics have recently played out in this country. Rabbi Rosen, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much.
For listeners who may not be familiar with HIAS, would you just give a very brief description, please?
Absolutely. So HIAS, some of our listeners may know as formerly as the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. HIAS is the oldest refugee organization in the world, and as you mentioned, it was founded in 1881, actually on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, to help to resettle Jewish refugees who were coming to the United States at that time. And for its first 120 years, HIAS rescued and resettled about 4.5 million Jewish refugees through all of the various waves of migration. And at the turn of this century, when there really ceased to be Jewish refugees, Hias decided to take all of its experience and relationships and expertise and work with refugees of all ethnic and religious backgrounds. So today we work with refugees in 12 countries around the world. We work with refugees resettling them here in this country, and we do advocacy work in the United States. And finally, we work to mobilize the American Jewish community in support of refugees. We like to say that we used to help refugees because they were Jewish, and now we help refugees because we are Jewish.
Jenny, you've been involved in a broad swath of activism around the issue of refugees. I'd like for you to talk about specifically the National Day of Jewish Action last weekend.
Absolutely. So the executive order, the really egregious attack on refugees and asylum seekers that was issued on January 27th, it became very clear that we needed a strong Jewish response to this and a statement of really standing with and standing for refugees. So we here at Hias mobilized a National Day of Jewish Action. The flagship action was here in New York City. About nearly 1,000 Jews came out in a sleet storm to stand in the shadow of the Statue of Liberty and raise up a voice in support of America continuing to live out its values and a reflection of Jewish values and continue to welcome refugees to our shore. We had a communal Havdalah service with about 600 people gathering in Washington, D.C., the night before, and then there were 20 sister actions around the country, Atlanta, Chicago, San Francisco, Boston, Kenosha, Wisconsin, a real mix of vigils and rallies, all of which were making a statement to say that the United States must continue to welcome refugees and refugees of all ethnic and religious backgrounds. One thing I'll just sort of highlight is that in addition to, obviously, it was an initiative that while it was run and sort of initiated by Hias, we had several dozen national Jewish organizations co-sponsoring it and really coming out in support of it. And so it was a broad swath of the American Jewish community really saying refugee issues are a Jewish issue. And the last thing I'll just mention is that I think we, in addition to having sort of politicians speak and Jewish leaders and Muslim leaders and refugees and sort of the folks you would imagine at a refugee, religious refugee rally, we also had a sort of ritual moment at the New York rally of Kriya. Kriya is the kind of rending of a garment that one in Jewish tradition does as a sign of mourning. So if somebody very close to you dies, one of the things that you do to mark that is to literally tear your clothing, or some people tear a black ribbon. And so we had in the middle of the rally a moment where we called up 10 members from the Jewish community representing different parts of the Jewish community, and 10 is the number of a minion, the number of people you need to pray in Jewish tradition. And those 10 people tore black ribbons really in reflection of the lives that will be lost if the United States does not open its doors to people who are fleeing persecution and war and violence. And we really wanted to lift up the fact that what we're talking about here are real human lives that will be lost if we're not able as a country to really continue to live out our foundational, as a country, you know, beliefs and commitments to welcoming refugees.
Now, Jenny, there was also a recent protest at Trump Tower that led to the unusual spectacle of rabbis being led away in handcuffs. Talk about that.
Sure. So Truah, the Jewish human rights, it's a rabbinic human rights organization. I think it's Truah, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights. So they're a partner organization of ours. And they had a conference, and at the end of the conference organized an action And Hyas was one of the co-sponsors of that action. It was a march from one of the congregations on the Upper West Side to Trump Tower. It was a very spirited march of rabbis and some community folks through sort of down the Upper West Side. And it culminated at the Trump Hotel with 19 rabbis doing civil disobedience in order to get arrested. And I think that the visual of, you know, many of the rabbis wore their prayer shawls, their talitot. There were some shofar rote, some of the ram's horns that were blown. And I think the visual of rabbis in talises being led away by New York City police really captured as a snapshot the Jewish voice and the way in which Jewish leaders are really saying, this is an issue that I care so deeply about that I'm willing to put my body on the line for it. Mm-hmm. You know, we right before the inauguration, we released a letter with more than 2,000 rabbis signed on to it, a letter saying that the U.S. must continue to welcome refugees regardless of their religion, their ethnicity, and their nationality. And so I think that to say that there's really a very broad support among rabbinic leadership for refugees, you know, would not be hyperbolic. I joke that getting 2,000 rabbis to agree to anything is nothing short of a small miracle. But the fact that more than 2,000 rabbis are saying this, you know, as Jews and as religious leaders, we believe that this is an issue of great, great importance.
What other kinds of direct actions are coming up across the country? And are there partnerships with non-Jewish activists forming?
Absolutely. In many of our many communities, so Hyas is working to mobilize Jews across the country. We have more than 300 congregations that have joined the Hyas Welcome Campaign, which means these are congregations that have made a commitment. They've both sort of issued a statement that the United States should remain a place that welcomes refugees, and they've committed to doing one thing over the course of the year. And many of those congregations, their work is in partnership with local churches and sometimes mosques and with other local religious communities of all different kinds. And that can range from advocacy. We have congregations that are meeting with members of Congress. That can be co-sponsoring a refugee family that's being resettled in their community, working as a congregation and in partnership with other congregations to help that family to become to get resettled, everything from securing housing and furnishing an apartment or a house and helping their kids enroll in school and figuring out how do you navigate the medical system in America and sort of all of the things that one would need to rebuild a life in a new country. And there are also, you know, community meals happening and fundraising that's going on both for, you know, given families in their community or for organizations that are supporting refugees. So we're really seeing a groundswell of support. And I think it's important to really stress that there's an incredible importance right now for advocacy. It could not be more important right now to really raise a moral and religious voice. And it's also incredibly important to create welcoming communities. If you can imagine what it would be like to arrive in America at this particular moment of such heightened anti-refugee rhetoric, of such hatred, of such bigotry. And so creating communities that are welcoming really on the ground in cities and towns across the country is also so important at this moment.
How effective is the demonstrations of unity in influencing national policy right now?
So, you know, we are in a moment, I think I'm probably stating the obvious, we're in a moment that really is unlike, you know, so many of the rules have changed. And we are all, I think, all of us, you know, religious people, religious leaders, Americans, people working on a whole host of different issues, we're all trying to assess, you know, what does it mean? How does one make change and raise one's voice in this new context? So, you know, the big caveat I would say is that we're still all, you know, figuring out what is this new game board that we're on? What is this new landscape? Having said that, I think that we absolutely are seeing that public displays of protest, of sort of prophetic calls, of raising our voices, the groundswell of grassroots advocacy has taken on a new life. And I think that's because it actually is an incredibly important tactic right now. We continue to encourage people to, you know, write to the administration and the White House, call the administration and the White House. Congress continues to be a really important body for activism, continuing to call, to have in-district meetings, to write letters. And I think more than ever, the public displays of protest really have a role right now to play. And I think we are, you know, starting to see some cracks in that. I think we're starting to see, you know, the way that what's been happening with this most recent executive order. I don't think that the challenges are unrelated to the incredible public outcry. I think that President Trump was really not prepared for people to show up at airports and start having rallies across the country and having religious leaders be arrested. And I think that there are real signs that it is having an impact.
You know, I have problem understanding the fact that so many families in the United States come directly from immigrants who came here to establish those families, and they seem not to be able to identify with what's going on and lend themselves to making a difference for good. Ultimately, what do you think it will take to address this issue in a more humane and more spirit-filled manner across the nation?
Well, I think you really kind of hit the nail on the head when you said, you know, everybody in this country, with the exception of Native Americans, has an immigrant past. And I think that it becomes really important to remind one another of that shared past. We don't have to go back that many, you know, years as a country for each person to identify when was it that their family came to this country. I was really struck. Several of the commercials around the Super Bowl, which I don't actually watch, but I was called in by some family members to see these commercials, were actually around this exact theme, right? Around the theme of reminding America, and there's nothing more sort of across America than the Super Bowl, right? That we are all, again, with the exception of Native Americans, we are all immigrants to this country, and we all came seeking a better life. Some of us came as refugees. Some of us came as asylum seekers. Some of us came as immigrants. But this is all of our story. And so I think that having people reconnect with that is so important. We have an action actually happening in front of the White House in D.C. On March 1st, in which people are bringing literally the photographs of their relatives who came to this country. So I think that having people reconnect with their story is a big piece of it. And I think the other is to really lift up where there is bigotry and where there is hatred, and to really be vigilant in calling that out, in calling out anti-refugee sentiment, in calling out anti-Muslim rhetoric. This is really a moment where I think we need to be, as Americans, holding each other accountable and really naming and responding and standing up when we see hatred and bigotry.
Yeah. Jenny, we're out of time, but I want you, please, before we get off, to tell our listeners how they can follow your work and become involved in it.
Absolutely. So www.hias.org, and our website has a great deal of resources, upcoming actions. You can learn about our international work and our domestic work, and how you can really become part of the movement in support of refugees, because this is such a critical time in our nation, and we'd love for you to join us.
Rabbi Jenny Rosen is Vice President for Community Engagement at HIAS, which has been working on behalf of refugees since 1881, rallying American Jews and allies around the global refugee crisis. HIAS slogan is "Welcome the Stranger, Protect the Refugee." Rabbi Rosen, I know these are not easy times, but what you're doing is absolutely crucial to the integrity of our nation and to the integrity of people who care about religion. Rabbi Rosen, thanks so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much.
Before we go, it's coming up fast. The 2017 Interfaith Alliance Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards Ceremony in Washington, D.C. We'll be celebrating the lifetime of work journalist Diane Rehm has shared with her listeners in Washington, D.C. and around the country. We'll also be honoring attorney, constitutional advocate, and Gold Star dad Kizer Khan. The reception and awards ceremony is Tuesday, April 4th at the Mitchell Gold and Bob Williams downtown Washington location. In addition to honoring two exemplary Americans, this is also an important fundraiser for Interfaith Alliance. Complete details are available at interfaithalliance.org. That date again, April 4th, 2017. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. We're counting on you. We're counting on you now more than ever. And quite frankly, so are many listeners who aren't able to find the voices that we amplify week after week anywhere else. If you've heard something that you found to be helpful on today's show, I urge you to share that with others who might also benefit from hearing it. It's easy to do that on Facebook and Twitter. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. That's stateofbelief.com. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. Be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.